waters of the Chesapeake Bay are rising faster than coastal waters almost anywhere else in the United States. In Maryland and Virginia, we already have lost many places to rising levels, and our cities are constantly under threat of major flooding. Chrisfield got walloped by Superstorm Sandy, and based on weather predictions, there are more Sandy-like storms on the way. Insurance programs still subsidize building and living in flood-prone areas, and no national policy yet exists to change our increasingly expensive desires to live on or near the water. Up next, Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell and a comprehensive new report on sea level rise and the Chesapeake Bay. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. It's time for Midday on the Bay. The Chesapeake Bay is rising twice as fast as the global average and much faster than most coastal areas in the U.S. And what does that mean for places like Ocean City, Chrisfield, Annapolis, Baltimore, Havre de Grace? And how bad could it get? Which areas are most vulnerable? And I just mentioned some. And can we stop it or at least slow it down? Joining us today for this discussion, as always, Midday on the Bay, is Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. She comes by once a month to chat about environmental issues. Rona, nice to see you again.
Thank you. You too.
And you brought along with you today Michael Fincham. Michael Fincham is a science writer and a documentary filmmaker with Chesapeake Quarterly. Chesapeake Quarterly is a publication of the Maryland Sea Grant, which is part of the University of Maryland. Michael Fincham, nice to have you with us, too.
Great to be here.
Let me just ask you about Chesapeake Quarterly and, first of all, Maryland Sea Grant, for those who aren't familiar with that.
Okay. There are actually 30-some Sea Grant colleges around the country, usually associated with land-grant colleges near the coasts and the Great Lakes.
Huh.
And it's funded by NOAA and by the states. It's a partnership between the federal government and the states. The idea is to encourage research and outreach and education connected to local maritime issues.
Hmm. How long has it been in place at the University of Maryland?
Since 1977.
Okay. Yeah. And the Chesapeake Quarterly is a publication of Sea Grant.
It is.
All right, Maryland Sea Grant. Now, the reason we have Rona and Michael here, they, along with other writers and photographers, put together, I think the word terrific is appropriate here, a terrific or rich package called Come High Water. That's what it's called. Come High Water, Sea Level Rise, and the Chesapeake Bay. When I say a package, I mean just that. There's stories, graphics, photographs, videos, and an interactive map of different places and the risks that they face when it comes to sea level rise. You can actually, let's see, if you go to the Dan Rodericks Facebook page, you want to start there, you can find the website with all of this information on it, all these elements. And one in particular I draw your attention to, folks, is the interactive map that allows you to see whether the neighborhood you live in, the place where you live, is at any risk of sea level rise. So let's start at the beginning. Of course, we know sea level rise is there. We've actually done shows on this in the past. But the conclusion, what you're reporting here about sea level rise in the Chesapeake being twice as fast as the global average increase, much faster than most any other place in the United States in coastal areas. We have to talk about this today. So, Rona, what got you into this partnership with Sea Grant and the Chesapeake Quarterly?
Well, sea level rise in the Chesapeake Bay, as you mentioned, is increasing very rapidly, and it is a big story, and we have a small staff. And Chesapeake Quarterly also has a small staff, but a very good staff. And we just sort of thought if we worked with them, we could cover both Maryland and Virginia. We could be much more comprehensive, and we could really do a good package. And I think we have. I'm glad you think so, too.
Michael, you already told us a little bit about Chesapeake Quarterly there. So, small staffs, big projects, so combined together. By the way, how long have you guys been working on this?
Oh, this particular project?
Yeah.
Mostly over the last year, but we've at different times written related stories, as has
so.
The Bay Journal.
So it's like a series, and then it's all together now in this package online.
Yes, right. And in fact, Sea Grant Chesapeake Quarterly put together this package, which has 15 stories and photos and graphics and videos. And the Bay Journal has additional stories from both our staff and their staff. And we will be rolling those out as part of the series over the next couple issues of the journal. So some stories that didn't fit into the package are going to be running in just our paper.
As I said, we've talked about it before on Midday on the Bay. Did anything surprise you in your reporting on this story, Rona?
Yeah, I was really interested in the people who deny sea level rise is happening. Yes, people who live on the coast and they can see out their window that the water levels are rising and they've lost chunks of their land, maybe chunks of, even of their retaining wall, and they continue to say that sea level rise isn't happening, or that climate change is not happening, or that climate change is happening, but it's not man-made, and there's nothing we can do about it. So I traveled to Dorchester County and Smith and Tangier Island, and I asked a lot of them, you know, what do you think is causing this problem? And many of them said it's just erosion. And the solution to the problem is for the Army Corps of Engineers to get some of that dredge from the Baltimore Harbor and make an island or two, or just, you know, come and put in a wall or a retaining wall or something, and that solves the problem. And they're not really connecting it to any of their own behaviors, and they're certainly not connecting it to the scientific reason for the sea level rise, the sort of global factors. They're looking at it very much as, you know, if you invest some money here, this will stop.
And these are people living in affected areas.
Yes.
Areas already affected with flooding, some damage to property already, wetlands plants growing in their backyards. I remember you mentioning that.
Yes.
And so they think, well, it's just erosion. And Michael, you want to comment about that? The Army Corps of Engineers will come along and fix things for us.
Well, it's interesting. She was surprised by what's happening in the Lower Eastern Shore. One of the things that surprised me in this was the search for engineering solutions. And the fact that was going on in some very large cities. I'm a D.C. boy, and I went to school, high school, in downtown Washington, D.C. I never knew that half the National Mall, almost half of it, is a flood levee that was built to counter the floods that we had in 1936.
You mean it was filled in?
Ah. If you walk along the reflecting pool, everybody knows the Lincoln Monument and the long reflecting pool.
Mm-hmm.
You walk along the reflecting pool, look north, you'll see a slight rise in land. That's a levee. That's a flood control levee. I never knew that. 2 weeks ago, I went down and filmed a removable flood wall that's being put up just next to the Washington Monument, practically, in order to 17th Street, which cuts between the Washington Monument and the reflecting pool, is a gap in the levee. They used to put sandbags. Now,
you're
now
talking about the levee that man built.
Man built.
Many years ago, yeah.
And the fact that now they want to build a wall that they can put up and take down when a flood comes.
Right. So that's what surprised you. Why does it surprise you, though? I mean, that somebody's actually making preparations.
Yes, and because of the seriousness that of the floods that they foresee in the future.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you about this on the science of sea level rise. That's why we have you here. Why is it rising faster here than in other places? I mean, we led with that. That seems to be the main conclusion that gets you into this package of stories and photographs and maps. Why is it rising faster here than in other places, and how do you know that for sure?
We know that from evidence of tide gauges over the, you know, since the early 1900s, there have been tide gauges that measure the height that the tides reach. Those have been going up. Those tide gauges document a consistent and accelerating rise. Since 1970, for instance, the rise is faster than it was between 1950 and 1970. So there's a definite rise going on. As far as the causes of the more rapid rise here, first you have to think a little bit about, you know, the warming temperatures are causing the ocean to expand, causing ice on the land to melt in Antarctic and the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the general causes. Along the mid-Atlantic, we have some other forces going on. The land is sinking slightly. Most of the eastern shore land is sinking slightly because that land was pushed up during the last serious glacial episode. The Laurentian Glacier used to sit on much of North America, including almost all of Pennsylvania. It pushed Pennsylvania down. It shoved Maryland, Virginia, the southern places, pushed that land up, just like a big boot coming down in the mud. You're going to see a footprint.
Right.
The edge of that footprint is the eastern shore. That's one of the edges. So you take away the ice.
So now there's what? Settling?
It's settling. Mm-hmm. It's settling.
And
it's,
so part of the answer is geological.
Part of it is this geological settling that's going on, accelerated or magnified a little bit by groundwater withdrawal. You know, we for farms, for our cities, you're drawing water out of the under the aquifers. That's also causing some additional sinking. Mm-hmm. There's some other weird physics going on. At the planetary level. I mean, we think of, okay, the ice caps are melting. Well, that has different effects in different places. Sea level does not rise uniformly around the globe. For instance, we are affected by what's happening, primarily by what's happening in Antarctica. The melting of land-based ice in Antarctica is not only putting more water in the ocean, expanding the ocean. There's another effect. When you have all this ice on the land and it melts, the gravitational mass changes. When the gravitational mass declines, water actually moves away from the source. When ice on Greenland melts, sea levels in Scotland go down.
Because the water's drawn away.
The water is no longer drawn towards it.
Right.
When ice in Alaska melts, water may go down in Seattle.
So bring that back to the Antarctic forest.
When Antarctic melts, we end up with more water coming in. We end up with a rise in sea level. Now, when we talk about this accelerated rise along the mid-Atlantic, because we're talking about the rising ocean and sinking land, we have to talk about relative sea level rise.
Relative sea level rise?
Yes, sea level rise, because the sea level is rising. That's one effect. The land is sinking. So relative to where the land was before, sea level is accelerated. And that's true for a whole 600-mile stretch north of Cape Hatteras.
Okay. What about other parts of the country? Say the West Coast, the Gulf Coast. We're actually ahead of those areas in terms of overall rise.
The rate of acceleration is
the rate of acceleration.
The acceleration is considered greater, sort of along the mid-Atlantic and further north, all the way up to Canada.
Rona, I want to go back to you on the subject of denial, which I find interesting. So someone even on Smith Island might be listening to Michael Fincham explain what he just explained and still be in denial about it, or they may be sitting in their backyard and there may be a flood event, and they'll think, well, that just happens. You know, floods come and go. That's a 75-year flood, 50-year flood. There'll be several years before that happens again. Tell us a little bit about the denial.
I think there's no denial that waters are rising in places like Norfolk, where you get major flooding, not just in hurricanes and nor'easters, but in daily rainstorms. I was there for one of them this summer when their tornado hit not too far from where I was, and it was pretty frightening. It doesn't take very long at all for the roads to flood and for the creeks to swell. The question of what causes it is where things get tricky, I think. And the question of how to prevent it is something that people are trying to tackle with both incremental changes and big changes. And I think the city of Norfolk seemed to be kind of in denial for a while, but then they really got religion on this and they started talking, instead of talking about intermittent coastal flooding, which is sort of a politically correct way of saying it, they started talking about sea level rise, climate change, and saying, you know, it is happening and here are some things that you can do. And they've gotten some very big grants to do things like flood walls and wetland parks and things like that. But it is interesting. I don't think anybody – there are people who deny that the sea is rising. But I don't think there's anybody who denies that water is coming into their homes more often than it used to. And they just attribute that to different things, to erosion and to other factors.
Is it because they don't want to connect it to climate change? The same people may also be in denial about climate change. Is that possible?
When Michael and I were on Hooper's Island, we talked to some very smart people who are lifelong Islanders. Hooper's Island is the island on the eastern shore where there used to be three towns, and there are now, I'd say, one and a half. One town is gone. One town is sort of half settled, and then there's a main town. And so, they're very conscious of what they've lost. And when you speak to them, And you ask them, and they sort of say, I can't really tell you about what's happening in Antarctica and if that's true or if that's not true. I do know that my grandmother said the water came up to the yard, and my mother said it came up to the first step, and I'm telling you it comes up to the porch. That's what I know.
Mm-hmm.
Why it's happening, I can't get my arms around that. It's kind of hard to believe when you're on Hooper's Island, Maryland, this tiny kind of spit of land on the eastern shore, that what's happening in Antarctica is somehow relevant to your life. Of course it is. But I think that's just a hard concept for people to totally embrace.
Rhona Cabell is staff writer for the Chesapeake Bay Journal. And with us in the studio today for this edition of Midday on the Bay is Michael Fincham, a senior science writer and documentary filmmaker with Maryland Sea Grant. They're with us today because the two organizations, Sea Grant through Chesapeake Quarterly and Rhona's Journal, the Chesapeake Bay Journal, have worked on a comprehensive series of stories, photographs, maps, videos about sea level rise in the Chesapeake Bay. That's what we're talking about. When we get back, we're going to hear from Michael Fincham again. He had a very interesting story in this package of journalism called The Perfect Surge, Blowing Baltimore Away, what scientists said about a possible storm surge, what effect that could have on downtown Baltimore City. So a short break on Midday on the Bay. If you have questions, feel free to call about this, 410-662-8780. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here. Midday on the Bay. Rhona Cabell back with us again, a Midday contributor and staff writer for the Bay Journal. Michael Fincham joining us today, senior science writer and documentary filmmaker with the Maryland Sea Grant, which publishes Chesapeake Quarterly. And I mentioned Chesapeake Quarterly again, folks, because you're going to want to see this this package of stories and photographs. Go to ChesapeakeQuarterly.net. Start there and look for their articles on sea level rise. And you won't miss this photograph by David Harp. Dave Harp's photograph of the last house on Holland Island. And this house disappeared 4 years ago. It's an amazing photograph. I've spent a lot of time looking at this picture.
Oh, yeah.
And we posted it and tweeted it out. Rhona, can you want to describe that for our listeners just a little bit?
Yeah, it is an amazing photograph of the last sort of weather-beaten house sitting in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay. And Holland Island had been an island where there was a baseball team. There were people who lived there. I think it was the last inhabitant of Holland Island left in like the late 1920s. And they took all the houses and they barged them over to Dorchester and Crisfield. And Mr. Todd, who owned an oyster shucking house down in Crisfield, he was the last survivor of Holland Island, and he died a couple years ago. So this house was the last remnant, and there was a guy who bought the house and was trying desperately to save it, and it slipped into the sea, and it happened sort of both slowly and all at once, and Dave was out there and was able to capture this amazing image of the house, and it really is an iconic picture of sea level rise, us trying to hold on to something and losing the battle.
Do you know why that heavy equipment is there? Is it like a Bobcat or a John Deere something there?
Yeah,
front-end loader or something.
I think that was probably part of the effort that the fellow who lived there, he was trying to get grant funding and
to
really
pull the house away?
Really
What was he trying to do, Michael?
To build up the land and
riprap
and various other protections.
But he wasn't trying to move the house.
No,
okay.
No.
The house was lost, I said, 4 years ago, 2010.
Yes. Right? He was trying to make it viable, to make the island viable again. And when you're on Smith Island, when you look out, you can still see a strand of trees on Holland Island, a strand of hardwood trees. There is still some land there. It isn't all disappeared, but it's just, I don't even know if you could really walk it. And of course, there are graves that are washed up and sort of have slipped into the sea or in various stages of falling into the sea, because those were not moved.
Rona, in a minute, you and I are going to talk about the two islands that are featured in this package of stories called Come High Water, Sea Level Rise, and the Chesapeake Bay. That's Tangier and Smith Island. We'll do that in a moment. I want to talk to Michael Fincham, though, a little bit to introduce to our listeners this story that he wrote based on some scientists gathering and discussing the possibility of what a storm surge could do given sea level rise to the Chesapeake Bay, and particularly to the city of Baltimore. Michael.
I was struck because one of the scientists at this day-long meeting said, well, if you got everything just right, you could blow Baltimore away. So,
yeah, perfect storm or a perfect surge.
Perfect surge rather than a perfect storm. Uh-huh. So I went and I got a whole lesson from him on the physics of what happens with a storm surge. To understand this, you have to think about, I was fascinated by the idea of the black swan idea. You're familiar with that? The black swan idea is events that are rare, extreme, and after the fact, predictable. And the argument has been that much of our history, both our personal lives and the history of our societies, revolves around black swan events. World War I, who predicted that? Who predicted the rise of Hitler? Who predicted the rise of the internet, the creation of the bomb, 9/11? After the fact, we sort of figure out an explanation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it gives us the feeling that we can predict these things in the future, you know, that we're not going to fall prey to black swan events in the future. To me, this was an interesting example of that. And much of this comes from an oceanographer named Bill Boycourt. He said, okay, here are the ways in which you could essentially blow Baltimore away. Through a storm surge. A storm surge that correlates with several other simultaneous surges. For instance, if you have a hurricane moving up on the west side of the bay,
Mm-hmm. The western shore.
That has a counterclockwise motion to its winds, which will drive water up the bay.
Okay.
You also have tide, the tide that comes in every day. You can have extremely high tides. They're called spring tides. They have nothing to do with the season. They have to do with the alignment of the Earth, the moon, and the sun. When they are in line at the new moon and the full moon, you have an extremely high tide. You can also have what's called, there's a moment when the moon is closer to the Earth than any other time at its perigee. That's a perigean high tide. Everything in the tide gets magnified. If that tide is moving at the same time the storm is moving, the storm surge is moving, you get this magnified effect. Oceanographers also talk of another thing that most people have trouble getting a hold of, the Seiche effect. Think of it as the slosh.
Spell that. Can you spell it?
S-E-I-C-H-E.
S-E-I-C-H-E, the Seiche effect.
And it's basically the slosh effect. Water sloshes around the bay like it sloshes around your bathtub. For instance, if you can see it.
I've seen it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, think about this. If you have wind blowing water down the bay, it rebounds.
Mm-hmm.
It will slosh back because as it blows down the bay, the water level gets lower. So the ocean level is going to be higher. The water's going to flow back in. You're going to get a rebound effect.
So who's the oceanographer who's putting together this perfect surge? His name is
William Boycourt.
Boycourt.
At the University of Maryland.
He's saying if you had all these factors, now where does sea level rise play into that?
Okay. We have this is like betting the trifecta at Preakness, at the Preakness, except yeah. You're betting that three horses will draw. There'll be a photo finish between storm surge.
That's the black swan.
The high tide.
So you went from black swan to horses, but that's
right.
Okay.
Yeah. I know, mixing my metaphors. So you get the storm surge, the high tide, the slosh effect.
Mm-hmm.
There's one other effect, one other horse in the race. And that's something that very little research has been done on. It's called the Proudman resonance. Basically, it's named after a person. It's basically the idea of the low pressure center of a storm is moving in sync with a storm surge. When there's low pressure, the water is higher. You get that. You get all those four things running together at the same time. you're going to blow Baltimore away.
Meaning you're going to flood downtown Baltimore.
You're going to flood downtown Baltimore in a way, in ways that it hasn't been flooded before. Now, and, that's still...
Excuse me. They're talking about this because of sea level rise.
Sea level rise...
adds urgency to this idea.
Yes,
right?
Because sea level rise accentuates everything. Mm-hmm. Each of those forces magnifies the other force. Sea level rise magnifies it even further.
So one last question about that, unless Rona had something. So maybe 100 years ago... if he were putting together this scenario, given the level of the Chesapeake at that time, maybe you wouldn't blow Baltimore away. Maybe you would just flood downtown a little bit, Pratt Street.
Most likely.
Yeah,
yes.
because the factor that what we're talking about today is sea level rise. So
sea level rise is adding to that.
Yes, right.
And it's not and it adds to it in a non-linear way. You don't simply add 1 foot of sea level.
Right.
You know. You're adding at least 20% more than that 1 foot because of these other factors. And because the bay, the geometry of the Chesapeake Bay is a funnel. It narrows. And that funnel aims directly at the head of the bay, and Baltimore is near the head of the bay.
Right.
It aims up the Potomac River at Washington, D.C., and Alexandria, Virginia. Those water levels during Isabel were higher in Washington, D.C., than they were at the mouth of the Potomac River because of the funnel effect. That funnel is creating greater surge when it hits the apex of the funnel.
Northern end of the bay.
The northern end, either Baltimore, Annapolis, Washington, D.C.
Havre de Grace, even further north, right?
Yes.
Michael Fincham, his story, The Perfect Surge, Blowing Baltimore Away, is part of this package of stories now pulled together online under the title Come High Water, Look at Sea Level Rise in the Chesapeake Bay. This is a collaboration of the Chesapeake Quarterly, where Michael works, and the Chesapeake Bay Journal, where Rona Cabell works. You're listening to Midday, Midday on the Bay, a special hour here devoted to this subject of sea level rise. Now, Rona, we're going to go back and talk about a couple of islands here. And we've talked about these before, but it's good to get an update here. The Chesapeake's last two big islands, Tangier and Smith Island, Tangier in Virginia, Smith Island in Maryland. Can you tell us a little bit about them, who lives there now, and what they're doing to protect themselves against the rising bay?
Sure. They're both about 11 miles from Crisfield in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay, and Tangier has more people. They have about 400 people on Tangier, but Smith has more land. So the Tangiermen all live in a very sort of tight area on three different ridges, whereas on Smith, there are actually three villages. One village is an actual separate island called Tylerton that you need to take a boat. It's about 2 miles from the other island, which is where Ewell and Rhodes Point are. And Ewell and Rhodes Point are connected by a road that's about a 2-mile-long road that floods frequently. And Rhodes Point may eventually split off and become its own island the way Tylerton has.
Okay. So are they considered the most vulnerable places in the bay right now in terms of sea level rise?
They are very vulnerable. The only place I would say that gives it a run for its money and vulnerability would be Dorchester, which has so many marshes that they're losing by Blackwater. But
that's where Blackwater Wildlife Refuge is.
Yes, and there's a lot of small communities, some African-American communities, too, in that area in low-lying Dorchester that are vulnerable. But you can't get much more vulnerable than a tiny piece of land in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay. And one of the things that's making both islands so vulnerable is they're losing these marshes that protect the habitat of the bay, the crabs and fish that use the marshes, but they're also sort of a bulwark against the rising water, and they sort of slow down the water. And because of erosion and the rising water levels, these marshes are going, and when they go, the islands become more inundated.
What do they have in mind? This is where you run into people who say, bring in the Army Corps of Engineers, let them build seawalls, bulkheads, protect us. Is that what they think?
Yes. And about 20 years ago, Smith Island on Tylerton got a seawall. And the seawall does sometimes take on water. But were it not for the seawall, Tylerton might not be here today. So in most cases, they're asking for Corps money, and the problem is that the Army Corps of Engineers budget has been cut, and also there's no more earmarks in the budget, which are the sort of special things that the senators and congressmen would give as gifts to communities. And so now Smith and Tangier have to get in line behind Norfolk and Miami and New Orleans for money in the budget for these projects. And when you're looking at should we protect 400 fishermen or New Orleans, you're going to go with New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So
Tangier has an airport over there. They have a little airstrip.
Yeah, they have a little airstrip. And it's been great for them because it enables the they do have a small government on Tangier. They have a mayor, and it enables him to get over to Richmond quickly and, you know, lobby for his community. And it enables they have a small medical center, and they have doctors who fly in to take care of people.
Did they protect the airport, and did Smith Island get anything out of this?
They protected the airport a few years ago, but Smith Island didn't get anything out of that. They got the seawall on Tylerton, and they have been waiting very anxiously for more money for some more protections that are coming soon, but they haven't gotten them yet.
Okay, so a cynical person might say it costs so much money to protect these places, and we have so many other obligations. You mentioned New Orleans, Miami, the federal government looking at this say, oh, just let it go. Why not let them go?
Over the summer, I wrote a lot about that on our blog as we were reporting this. And I admit, I love these islands, so I'm not objective about it. My argument is that these places are really special, and not only because you couldn't meet nicer people, but because they give you a snapshot into a way of life that really is no more. It's not just the quaint Elizabethan accent that you hear. It's their devotion to God. It's their devotion to the Chesapeake, to their families, and very significantly, their devotion to nature. I think we should do whatever is possible and practical to make sure that these islands are with us for as long as we can hold on to them.
You mentioned that Elizabethan accent
yes.
on Smith Island. Did you
yes.
get used to it? You were able to understand people? Did you have to ask people to write down words that they were speaking sometimes?
Smith, I'm fine. Tangier is funny. Tangier does the backwards talk. So if a Tangierman sees a really good-looking lady, he'll say, "She ain't pretty none." And
really?
That means she's gorgeous.
Really?
But, you know, you have to get used to that. It's not something I heard. That's something I read in a book. But, you know, you have to sort of pay attention to that. And after a while, you can sort of figure it out.
I can understand why you would feel, having visited those places, why you would feel, as you do, that we should do whatever is possible and practical to make sure those islands stay with us. I wonder, from a scientific point of view, Michael Fincham, I'll go to you on this. What do you think is going to happen to Tangier and Smith? And do you feel the same way Rona does about them?
I'm certainly in favor of trying to preserve them as long as possible because of the cultural values that that they represent for the state, for a whole way of looking at life that's a part of the Maryland experience. Science has something to say about this, but history has a lot to say. And what history says is that at one point there are probably 400 islands that are gone. Chesapeake Islands. If you go back to the early days of settlement, many of these islands, we don't even know the names anymore. And a number of them, we know the last 13 that have disappeared. We have their names. But if you look in the land records, there were many more islands that have since disappeared.
And it's the combination of the rising and sinking.
Most likely.
The rising water, the sinking land.
Yeah. I mean, the sea level rise is accelerated, but this process has been going on for quite a while, the loss of those islands. It gives pause to think about the fate of people like places like Tangiers and Smith.
Do scientists who look at this put any kind of a clock on it, on those particular islands? In terms of, you know, how long they think they'll be around based on what we're seeing in terms of rising water, falling land?
They may. You'll have to give me the phone. I can call Bill Boyko.
Okay. Well, you don't have it. It's all right. I just wonder whether anyone makes a prediction, an actual prediction, to tell people on Smith Island or Tangier, you know, you have probably till 2030 or 2050 to live there.
Well, it's not a question just of the loss of land. They can measure the loss of land, but there's the loss of the store, the church, the loss of families.
Right.
And
how long can you live there if those things go away?
And after a while,
right.
The social costs of living there accelerate.
Let me ask Rona about that. There was a talk about I don't know, a couple of years ago that we were going to buy out the people of Smith Island, actually buy them out.
Right. I never understood this story. And then this summer, I finally got the story behind the story. listeners might remember after Sandy, the state offered Smith Island a buyout. And the deal was basically, we'll give you the highest appraised value ever for your land. In exchange, you move and the land becomes dead. So you can never build on it ever. No one can ever build on it ever. And what was odd about this deal is that Smith Island sustained very little damage from Superstorm Sandy, and Crisfield, which is where most of the people would probably end up moving, was hammered by
Sandy. Got walloped in Sandy.
Yeah, and Michael did a terrific story about that in the package. So
it didn't make much sense then.
It didn't make sense until I spent a couple days there and I kind of figured out what happened. And basically, it's very easy to be seduced by real estate on Smith Island.
Did you buy some?
I didn't buy anything. I came home with a leg infection instead. You get off the boat and you see these adorable little houses, and they're $110,000. So it's not money I have in my pocket, but it's certainly for a vacation home, much more reasonable than Ocean City. And so tourists come and they have these real estate listings and they buy a house, and then they realize that it's not easy to maintain a house on Smith Island. Buying is easy, but owning, not so much. You need a plumber or a drywall guy or even groceries, and you're basically reliant on ferries if you don't have your own boat. And so for a lot of people over the years who have bought these vacation homes, they kind of realized that it wasn't for them. And then when they went to go sell their home, they found that their mortgage was underwater. So the crabbers and the watermen who have lived there their whole lives, this didn't really affect them, but it affected a lot of the newcomers. And one of the people who was relatively new was a real estate agent, and she and a couple other people started lobbying the state to offer this buyout. And it was only after the state put it on the table that Smith realized that the state really considered their island in jeopardy.
Did they get any Sandy money?
That's the funny thing. Eventually, they did get $15 million for the Sandy storm that barely touched them. Mm. And the way it happened was that Smith Island has no government, but they organized and they lobbied Senator Jim Mathias and others to, instead of giving up on the island, to work to save it. So there's an $8 million project going on that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is doing to preserve marshes. And then there's going to be another project in Rhodes Point to preserve the harbor. And then there are various other projects. So in a way, it kind of
a good result.
It worked out well.
They weren't damaged much in Sandy at all.
No.
But they got $15 million, and it sounds like they're putting it to good use.
And these are projects that they desperately needed. So in a way, a good outcome.
Rona Cabell and Michael Fincham with us. We're talking about the package of stories that they produced in collaboration with Chesapeake Bay Journal and Chesapeake Quarterly. That you can find online. You can find a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. We'll take some calls when we get back. A short break on Midday on the Bay. And welcome back to Midday on the Bay, a special program today devoted to taking a look at the results of all this journalism that's been conducted on the subject of sea level rise and the Chesapeake Bay. So Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal is with us as usual. But Michael Fincham also joining us from Maryland Sea Grant, which publishes the Chesapeake Quarterly. Chesapeake Quarterly and Chesapeake Bay Journal worked together to put this package together called Come High Water. You can find it at ChesapeakeQuarterly.net. Photographs, stories about people all around the bay preparing for, in different ways, sea level rise, some not preparing because they're in denial about it. And there's interactive maps. You can even go there and take a look at your part of the state, wherever you live around the bay. Click on it, and you can find a story about that area, or you can see whether your neighborhood is threatened by the rising Chesapeake Bay. Austin in Baltimore had a comment or a question for us. Welcome to Midday, Austin.
Hi, thanks very much.
Go right ahead.
My question was, has anybody discussed or heard of a discussion about doing what they've done in a lot of European cities or some, you know, in Holland and whatnot, where they build a huge wall against the water entering a big waterway that has a gate that can open or close when there's a super tide or a hurricane?
Rona. Rona had something on that, Austin. Did you have something else you wanted to add?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that had been already answered.
No. She's going to. But you weren't finished.
Sure. So, you know, I think when you compare the cost of building a large project, because cost would be an immediate concern, you know, and then you compare that against all the small projects that we would need to do, building walls here and there, I mean, you could protect Washington, Baltimore, and every small town along the way with one project, maybe along where the Chesapeake Bay Tunnel is. And then when you balance that cost also against the cost of the next hurricane or black swan event, you know, maybe that cost becomes a little more palatable. And we all buy, none of us think our homes are going to burn down, but we all have fire insurance or home insurance. So, you know, we need an insurance policy for what scientists will tell us is coming.
Thank you, Austin. Okay, Rona, so, and then we'll go to Michael.
Yeah, I'll take the first part, and then Michael maybe can speak about more of the science part of it. So I think the people in the city of Norfolk have the Dutch on speed dial. they've used this firm called Fugro, which is famous in the Netherlands for flood control, and then Old Dominion University hired somebody named Hans-Peter Flag, who is both German and spent some time in the Netherlands, and we talked to him extensively about this. You know, what can we learn from the Dutch? Because I didn't know until I did the story that there were major floods in the Netherlands back in the 1800s. I mean, thousands of people died. And as a result, the Dutch got very smart about how to protect against floods. And there's very good cooperation between Germany and England and the Netherlands and the other countries about how to do this, and they're investing billions of dollars in these projects. And I sort of asked, you know, why aren't we doing that here? And the answer was, we're Americans. We don't like taxes. We're not real big on cooperation. We're independent and
top-down government.
And right. and you know, these things, the price tag for these things is nowhere near cheap. It's millions, billions more. And so Michael has some stories about places that are looking at doing projects like what Austin talked about. But, you know, my sense is that probably not going to happen.
Gee whiz. All right, Michael.
Well, currently there is a theoretical study going on about building something similar to what Austin's talking about, building a floodgate across the mouth of Chesapeake Bay. This would also allow water to come in and out, so you'd have sections that would open. And it's loosely similar to what the Netherlands did with a project they called the Delta Works, which actually closed off the mouths of two estuaries and includes dams and locks and sluices and gates that open. The study on the Chesapeake Bay is just at the theoretical level right now. And it's almost an exercise in seeing if they can get their physical models and their ecological models and their social models to communicate with each other. But nevertheless, the National Science Foundation was interested in funding such a theoretical study. And Austin had a very good point. While this may cost billions of dollars, add up all the costs affecting if the perfect surge hit Baltimore or Washington or Alexandria and Norfolk.
Right.
What are the costs of all those separate cities, as well as the smaller islands? You know, what are the costs when they're flooded because of storm surges that might have been stopped?
I talked about Annapolis. I mentioned Chrisfield, Havre de Grace, Ocean City. We haven't even talked about Ocean City. And, of course, Baltimore. Are officials in any of those places talking about this?
Well, as I said, the study on the floodgate at the mouth of the bay is
but I mean
it's
individual,
just a theoretical hypothetical.
No, I mean individual communities. Do we know? Is anybody talking about this on the local level?
Well, yes. I think there are. Michael could speak more about Chrisfield because he was there. But I went to a community called Saxis, Virginia, that is probably going to be gone in the next few decades. Its road will flood. Its houses are sort of a hodgepodge in various stages of being raised. No two houses seem to have the same riprap in front. And they're talking about, how do we survive? What do we do to survive? Baltimore actually is talking about putting in regulations to build new construction in Fells Point and other places would be above the base flood elevation. Norfolk passed a law that you can't build anything in the city that's, it has to be 2 feet higher than base flood elevation. So people are doing things, but there is no sort of national effort or even really a cohesive state policy. I mean, the state has a policy, but the state can't force a jurisdiction to do something.
Here's a few emails I want to read and get your comments. Michael Fincham and Rona Cabell. One is just an observation about the interactive map that's part of the package that your organization's put together. Lanza says, playing with the interactive map, one of the first areas in Baltimore to flood is Harbor Point, the site where they are building the new Exelon Tower. Seems like a bad idea to me. I'm going to read John's comment first, and then Cranston gives us one maybe we can end the hour on. John says he recently became aware of two possible impacts of life in Maryland with sea level rise. One, a relative of mine lives in an Anne Arundel County community that relies on septic systems and well water. Several homeowners in the community have told me of septic systems that no longer function properly and drinking water wells that have been contaminated by brackish bay water due to sea level rise. And then he says, I have a high school friend who is a retired PhD geologist with long experience in hydrology. When I emailed him about these problems, he replied that, in his opinion, if sea level rises as expected, to expected levels, large portions of the eastern shore will be uninhabitable due not only to the flooding, but because of inability to use well water and septic systems. He wonders if you have any comments on that. I mean, it seems pretty astute and interesting, but...
Well, well water comes from aquifers, and saltwater intrusion in aquifers has been an issue already, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure is tied directly to sea level rise. It's been a problem on Kent Island at times. It's been a problem in Ocean City at times.
But could it get worse with rise?
I would guess so, but...
We'd need a hydrologist on the show.
We would for that. I mean, because essentially you're talking about water...
Yeah.
Not water coming over the land, but water coming
into the
aquifers that, right. that lie underneath the bay.
And this last one, I'll give it to you both, and you can comment on it. Cranston writes in, given the level of abstraction that a scientific understanding of what is happening requires, does anyone have an idea about how to market rising sea levels to average people? Well, I think you're doing your part here with this collaboration. And Cranston, I recommend that you read it, spend some time with that. It's a rich package of material. But Michael, you have any thoughts about that before we close out for the hour?
How to market sea level rise? You mean how to educate sea level?
Yeah, I mean we're doing our part here on the radio, but and you've done your part.
I think the great educator is experience. And I hate to say it, but you know,
floods.
A major flood in Baltimore, the major flood in Crisfield. People learn from those. Interestingly, in Crisfield, the Holland Island people who had to move off their disappearing island, and they moved to Crisfield. Most of them built their houses up fairly high.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey Todd said, I sat there and watched the whole lower part of the town surrounded by water. But he wasn't flooded. He was sitting above the water.
So he
the
learned.
Islanders knew.
The Islanders
That's the
did.
Son of the last man to be born on Holland Island, Casey Todd.
Right.
And do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, I feel like you're doing your part as a journalist,
oh,
right?
Thank you. I try to do my part on all of these issues, the so-called rain tax, the Conowingo Dam, sea level rise, to put it in sort of layman's terms so that people do understand it. And I find that when you do, I think people do accept it.
Well, take a look at this. I don't see how you could not accept it after reading this. Come High Water, the stories, interactive map that we've mentioned, photographs and videos put together by the Chesapeake Bay Journal and Chesapeake Quarterly, a publication of Maryland Sea Grant. You can find it at ChesapeakeQuarterly.net. And Rona, your colleagues, Leslie Middleton, Daniel Strain, Dave Harp, the photographer, Sandy Rogers. I guess I mentioned, did I mention everybody?
Oh, that's great.
That's
Thank
it?
You. For...
Is that the group who worked on this?
Yes. We forgot our editors, Carl Blankenship, Michael Schultz, and Jeffrey Brainerd, our bosses.
Okay.
Thank you to them for...
It's very good.
Thank you.
It's more than very good. It's actually excellent. Thank you for doing it. And Michael Fincham, nice to meet you and have you on the show.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Rona. Thank you, everybody,
Thank you.
For tuning
Thank
in.
Thank you very much.
Yep, we'll see you again soon.